Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on Earth.
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes the elements of a successful revolution. From Talk of the Nation on NPR, Shadid Hamid and Simon Chama comment on what makes a successful revolution more likely to succeed or fail. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Ananda Gopal. Independent journalist Ananda Gopal discusses why counterinsurgency strategy works better in theory than in practice. He explains how the denying Al-Qaeda sanctuary justification for U.S. military deployments ignores the real reasons the 9/11 attacks succeed. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Eric Margolies. Eric Margolies discusses Egypt's fake revolution. He comments on the criminal charges against former Pakistani President Musharraf and reminds us of the still unsolved mystery of who really killed Benazir Bhutto. And then after that, how close are we to the edge? As food prices rise and civil unrest builds throughout the Middle East, Lester Brown wonders if these two could be connected.
Historians, why do some revolutions fail while others succeed? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And we begin with Simon Chama, University Professor of History at Columbia, who joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
And I wonder, as you've looked at history, and I know you're a particular expert on the French Revolution, what is it that makes one revolution succeed and another fail?
Well, revolutions are acts of force. You know, it's when a lot of us celebrate the insurgency of people that you tend to forget, actually, the tough realities of what revolutions actually are over the centuries since the French really invented the modern form in 1789. Isn't it striking? How many times, Neil, have you heard the word carnival-like atmosphere, actually? Yeah, can we retire that, please? Carnivals are not revolutions, actually. And the extraordinary thing which is sort of moving about Tahrir Square is the persistence and tenacity of all the people there. But weirdly, if you are too carnival-like and you actually don't redirect and harness all that popular energy strategically against the institutions of power, you end up actually sitting in your own prison. It looks like a carnival, but actually life goes on around you and you become a kind of museum of failed revolutionary energy.
Can you give us an example of where, somewhere where that happened?
Well, it happened a little bit, actually, in 1968 in Paris. I was, my only experience of really being gassed for liberty, really, along inadvertently, I have to say. Well, not entirely inadvertently, but let's not get into my dalliance with insurrection. But in 1968, you remember, the streets were full of a very sort of disparate coalition of the disaffected, led, of course, by students, by young people then as well, and into challenging the authority of General de Gaulle's state in the Fifth Republic. Into the mix came the trade unions, and for a while, workers and students, the kind of dream ideal of the revolutionary romance, actually looked as though it was going to bring the Fifth Republic down. At that point, General de Gaulle, not to give you a lengthy history, mm-hmm. actually made contact with the head of the army, camped out in eastern France, but he could see already, as could his prime minister, Georges Pompidou, that really this group had nothing in common. And once the government, in effect, paid off the union side of the coalition of the angry, leaving what was left was a kind of theatre, a spectacle. It was indeed a carnival. And ultimately, most people in France actually got tired of what they thought of as student shenanigans. So, you know, Woody Allen at the end of Annie Hall, a crucial source for us in thinking about this, says, "Love is like a shark. Unless it moves forward, it dies." The same actually is true of revolutions. Revolutions thrive on the symbolic and the strategic. They do need symbolic humiliations. That's why all the emphasis is on, we will not talk to the government, to Suleiman, until Mubarak is so humiliated that he steps down altogether. But symbolic action won't work unless you have a very strong strategic sense of actually where you can actually jam up the works of the functioning of government. And in that sense, it was one of the sort of bad sign for the revolution in Cairo that the banks started opening again today, even though the stock exchange hasn't.
And in that sense, does not that strategic sense require organization, require leadership, which is one of the things that seems to be lacking in Tahrir Square?
That's exactly right. The European experience is, sort of windbags for liberty, like me. Professors, students, professional writers have no trouble at all in constituting themselves as provisional revolutionary committees, committees for the dawn of democracy, committees mm-hmm. against despotism. Please, you know, the extraordinary thing is we're a bit committee starved, a sentence I never thought I'd hear myself utter in the case of Egypt. Even if it is going to be very provisional, what you don't want is simply a relatively sectarian group like the Muslim Brotherhood to constitute the only group that know actually what they want out of political and constitutional change.
Well, joining us is Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. He's an expert on democratization in the Middle East. He joins us from the BBC studios at Western House in London. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And does history, in your opinion, give any guidance as to what may come to pass in Egypt?
Yeah, transitions usually work in a particular way. You have protesters on the ground that are pushing hard, that have, in some sense, uncompromising goals. As we see in Egypt, the protesters do not want to back down from the demand that Mubarak step down. So you have that, but in parallel, you have opposition elites, and they're usually not the people who are in the square protesting, and you have negotiated pacts that really happen in backdoor deals between the elites and the regime forces. And I think that's what we're seeing now, where you have this, for example, this so-called Committee of Wise Men that is negotiating, presumably, on behalf of the protesters, even though they haven't been authorized to do so. And we're seeing a proliferation of these committees of independents and opposition elites who are trying to get a piece of the pie. And again, we see a disconnect between the protesters in Tahrir Square and the people who are in the rooms negotiating with the regime. In other words, transitions are messy, they're uncertain, and oftentimes the protesters or the opposition more generally will have to make compromises they otherwise wouldn't make.
Well, the elites may make those compromises on their behalf without telling them, and thereby lies a danger. They may accept them, they may not.
Right. But protesters won't, at least some of them will not accept what comes out of these deals between both sides, and that's why they're likely to continue protesting. And that seems to be the plan right now, to continue having a presence in Tahrir Square really indefinitely. But that's not really a strategy, and that's been one of the big questions. what do the protesters want to achieve? How do they plan to achieve it? What are the mechanisms for change? It's one thing to bring hundreds of thousands onto the streets. It's another to translate that into effective, tangible political action. And that seems to be lacking right now.
In any case, can I come in for a second?
Yeah. Simon Sharma, go ahead.
Because it's so interesting. You know, the European tradition really, because the history of the French Revolution is so imprinted generation after generation, it was important for the Russians in 1917 mm-hmm. and so on. There was already an education in exactly this problem, the problem being that those who constitute themselves as elite committees actually only have the cards they can play when they can mobilize popular anger out there in the streets. But the people who are, who are actually themselves part of the demonstration of popular anger can't do anything with it unless they do have the politicians there. So they have to, what Egypt is going through, it seems to me, from a great distance, is a kind of improvised education in that at some point. And this is why, the wily Suleiman and who knows what's happening at the in the army command with this divided and united, are sitting there waiting and watching for the moment when the committees are, can actually constitute, they can actually plug in to the energy they're getting from Tahrir Square. And the people in Tahrir Square understand it's pointless staying there unless they have a plan of action for the politicians to go forward. And that's a real kind of education on the spot, which is very difficult. It's fraught with danger. And if you divide those two forces, you'll find someone in the army will drive one of those tanks right through it.
And Shadi Hamid, it's the word army is an interesting one, and it connects a lot of revolutions. Which side does the army select, and is the army unified? The idea that we in the United States have the purposes of armies are to fight and win wars, not necessarily true in much of the world, where the purposes of armies are to keep the regime in power.
Well, yeah, what's interesting about the army in the Egyptian case is that in the initial days of the protest, there was a lot of euphoria about the military siding with the protesters and playing essentially the same role it played in Tunisia, an honorable role of protector of the people and refusing to shoot and all of that. I think we got the military a little bit wrong in Egypt in that respect. Yes, they did play an honorable role in terms of not shooting or refusing to shoot, but at the end of the day, they still are part of the regime structure, and that's what we're seeing.
They refused to protect the people against the pro-Mubarak protesters.
Exactly. So that's where we start to see there was some confusion. Is the military with the protesters? Is it with the regime? At the end of the day, it benefits quite a bit from the status quo. Let's keep in mind that the new vice president is a senior military man, former army general. So that was part of a regime effort to consolidate control over the military. That appointment, as well as the appointment of other security military types in the positions of interior minister and prime minister. So now the army seems to be saying, well, protesters, we understand your demands. We see what you're coming, where you're coming from. But now Mubarak has made concessions. We're moving in a positive direction. It's now time for you to go back home and let's get this country back on track and back to normal life. And that seems to be where the military is right now. They don't seem to be very sympathetic to this idea of even more changes or radical change. And that's why they seem to be coalescing behind Omar Suleiman, the vice president, right now. And that's where we really see the start of this so-called counter-revolution, which I'd say began on Wednesday after the euphoria and jubilation of Tuesday night, where I think a lot of people felt Mubarak would fall any moment. This is not a regime to be underestimated, and they have done a fairly impressive job in recent days of regaining some of their lost momentum.
We're talking with Shadi Hamid, a director of the research at the Brookings Doha Center, with us from London, and it was with Simon Sharma, university professor at Columbia, an historian and an expert on the French Revolution. Why do some revolutions succeed? Tehran, 1979. Why do some people power movements utterly fail? Tiananmen. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Cunnan in Washington. In Egypt today, members of the Muslim Brotherhood threatened to pull out of talks with the government if President Mubarak does not resign. The group was one of the few willing to negotiate. President Mubarak offered some concessions, but insists he will stay until his term ends in September. Whether the protests lead to a more representative government remains to be seen, but history gives us some clues as to why some revolutions are more successful than others. Historians, why do some revolutions fail? Why do others succeed? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center, and historian Simon Shama, University Professor at Columbia in New York. And let's get a caller on the line. We'll start with Francine. Francine with us from Denver.
Hi. Revolutions succeed just as an authoritarian regime begins to liberalize. In other words, those regimes that truly crack down put out any sparks immediately. For example, the first Iranian revolution happened when the Shah was under pressure to give some civil rights and loosen up and not be so brutal. And that's the moment when a revolution can happen. Had the army been called out and had they gone out on the Egyptian streets and cracked heads and have horrible injuries and murders, there would be no situation at the moment. I mean, that's a horrible thing to think, but it seems that that's the case.
Simon Shama, certainly in the Bolshevik case or the Russian case, the transitional government there provided some, what Francine would say, some civil liberties, some change, and then gave way to the Bolsheviks.
Francine is exactly right. Before the March Revolution, actually, of course, there'd been a great period of liberalization, the creation of a representative Duma, which was a sort of apprenticeship for jockeying among opposition groups in Russia. It's also the case, as Alexis de Tocqueville reminds us always in his eternal wisdom, that actually the old regime in France was not a kind of arthritic tyranny. It had illusions of its own liberalization. So she's absolutely right. The issue, however, is because of those liberal moments, and one could say actually that even though the Mubarak regime certainly hadn't liberalized its state security apparatus, we are talking about an Egypt with a fairly respectable performance in economic growth. We're not talking about an Egypt absolutely stuck. For all the numbers of the destitute in Egypt, mostly the economic pain was felt about the young, the people who are on the streets. So the issue is really, when you're in this period of relative modernization, how does the leader present himself essentially as a supreme nationalist, the incarnation of the country? It's always a danger when you're old and decrepit and you somehow don't seem to represent Egypt. And in the Egyptian case, the army, going way back to the uprisings of 1882 against the British and the French, the army has always seen itself as the cradle of reasserted national dignity, three wars against Israel and so on. So it is the case that the army, in their back rooms, trying to find a way in which some figure or some force can come forward and take on board the constitutional reforms, which are clearly absolutely critical to an Egyptian national regeneration, without simply surrendering power over the process to the street.
And Shadi Hamid, let me ask you about a transitional figure in Iran who's written recently that after his experience as president after the 1979 revolution, Abul Hassan Banisadr, we're talking about. He said one of the lessons he's learned he'd hoped to lead a democratic movement, one of the things you never do is form a revolutionary guard.
Right. If we're talking, certainly the IRGC in Iran, the Revolutionary Guard, has played a role that I think many of us are aware of in terms of taking Iran in a very different direction than some of the original revolutionaries intended. And I think Iran's a very interesting case of how a revolution gets out of hand and starts out liberal and democratic and becomes something altogether different. Iran is an instructive case, although it's not one that I think is particularly relevant when we're talking about Egypt. And I think there's been a lot of comparisons made in recent days, especially about the Muslim Brotherhood and the alarmism that we're hearing from Washington, that this might start out as a liberal democratic revolution, but then the Islamists will hijack it. So I think Iran has had the ability to to, I think, taint our understanding of how change occurs and has really contributed to a paranoia about Islamists. And, I mean, we can certainly have a discussion about the Brotherhood, but suffice it to say, the Brotherhood is a relatively moderate and mainstream organization that isn't even nearly comparable to Khomeini and the people around him in 79.
Obviously, each case is different, and clearly one is a Sunni country, one is a Shia country with very different traditions about the engagement of clerics in temporal structures, if you will. But Simon Shaman, nevertheless, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, very well organized, at least in part because of repeated and consistent and persistent attempts to suppress it, so organized into resilient kinds of political structures. And there is a history in all kinds of revolutions of resilient minorities, small groups, but better organized groups, taking advantage.
Yeah, I do agree with the criticism of alarmism about the Muslim Brethren. They are, you know, have been ferociously condemned by al-Qaeda as being insufficiently jihadist. However, you're absolutely right, Neil. It's true, wherever you look, revolutions, as one of the Girondin minority in the National Convention in France famously said, tend to devour their own children. And it's very hard to look at all-out revolutions and find ones. The Central European Velvet Revolutions were a case in point because Soviet military power decided to abdicate, that don't end up in the dictatorship of very well-organized minority groups. That was the case of the Bolsheviks, who, when they were in power, you know, immediately dissolved the Provisional Constituent Assembly and persecuted their opponents and locked them up. It was the case in Jacobin France. It was obviously the case in China. And it certainly was the case. You could say that for all its fundamentalist Islamic character in Iran, Iran was absolutely following the course which popular revolutions, alas, often do. Egypt is different. It may be that it's Egypt's redeeming quality, having said it lacks a strategic sense of where it's going, is indeed its chaos. It's sort of pluralistically chaotic, the quality right now. The fact that Muslim Brethren do not sort of giving off a kind of particularly Bolshevik odour. They may teach themselves to adopt the cunning, the wait and see and then pounce game that the Bolsheviks did in 1917. That remains to be seen. But I will say that what usually enables such tough, well-organized minorities to put themselves in a position of a dictatorship is usually the foreign intervention, the threat of a foreign war, the sense of a foreign conspiracy. This happened in Iran, Chinese had fought a civil war, it certainly happened in revolutionary France. That is the classic template. If somebody from the outside puts a great hobnail boot in the stomach of the revolution, generally power falls to the most militant of the opposition.
I have to disagree with that a little bit in the sense that the international factor in Egypt, I think, will work out in a different way. The U.S. is going to be involved in this transition. It already is, and that's what we're going to continue to see over the next year or 2 years. And it's very difficult to see how the Brotherhood or any other organization could pounce and really come into the political vacuum. The U.S. is overseeing all of this, and all the parties involved in Egypt are very sensitive to the fact that the world is watching, the world cares, and that's why the Muslim Brotherhood is purposely playing a limited role, because they know that if they play a more visible role, that is going to frighten the international community and particularly the U.S. So I think for the foreseeable future, the Brotherhood is going to purposely limit its involvement in any interim or transitional government, because it knows that once it has more than a limited number of ministries, say, in a unity government, that is going to cause an international outcry. And I think the examples of failed revolutions in, say, Algeria 1991-92, an example that I don't know enough of us remember, and also Hamas coming to power in 2006, Islamists have learned that sometimes it's better not to rule. The world isn't quite ready for Islamists just yet.
Is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. took out the kid. It's something you did, God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills, you only got 10. Maggie calls Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA, look out, kid, don't matter what you did, but walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your plain clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around an inkwell, hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get fucked, get back, ride frail, get jail, jump bail, join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters, grilled by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool. Don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meter. Oh, get born, keep warm, short pants, romance. Learn to dance, get dressed, get blessed. Try to be success, please her, please him. Buy gifts, don't steal, don't live. 20 years of schooling and it put you on the day shift. Look out, kid, they keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try to avoid the scandals. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump don't work cause the vandals took the handle.
And now for something completely different.